Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here tonight with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. And tonight, I'm going to say that we are honored to have a very special guest here.
I kind of figured maybe you'd go back to special.
Yes, because, but yeah, it's kind of, it is special.
I am very honored.
Yes.
And I actually ran into your lovely husband earlier and mentioned that we were going to have this guest.
Yes. And it's been years in the making because I have been trying to get this person in our recording studio for as long as I've been on the show. And today is the first day that we've had. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name's Norm Quila. I live in Warrenton.
Yeah.
And Alana is your daughter-in-law.
Alana is my sister, or my
daughter-in-law. That's me. So we're so happy to have my father-in-law here tonight to talk about growing up in Astoria.
And a lot of exciting things. So we should get right to it. I'm not even going to give the normal plug for the garden group working on the grounds of the Flavel House every Monday night from 5 to 7 or Wednesday mornings from 10 to noon, making an amazing difference. The Flavel House grounds look fantastic.
Snacks and supplies provided.
Snacks and supplies. And you don't have to come every time, but I'm not even going to talk about that because we have so much to talk
about. Exactly.
All right. So let's get right to the history highlights, things that happen tomorrow.
Yep.
And then we're going to talk to a huge history highlight, the entire program is going to be history hot.
It is.
All right. So August 23rd, 1814, Dolly Madison saves the portrait of George Washington from the British.
Ooh.
You know, because they burned down most of Washington. And she saved a whole bunch of documents. And we actually did a show about this years ago. There was like an archivist that saved a whole bunch of documents, including like the Declaration of Independence and other things. So.
The recognition is for the portrait.
Yes. Because, you know, not every hero wears a cape.
Right.
Sometimes an archivist could be a hero.
That's true.
All right. 1904, the automobile tire chain is patented.
Oh.
Now, do you ever put chains on your cars?
Do I? No.
Do you ever drive a car with chains on it?
Yes.
Okay. It's kind of ingenious.
It is.
Yeah. 1939, not a good one. Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union agree on the Molotov-Ribbentrop non-aggression pact and secretly divide Poland between themselves.
Ooh.
So that's August 23rd, and of course, World War II starts, depending who you talk to, but Germany starts September 1 in invading Poland, and then that's when England and France says, hey, we gotta stop this.
And Poland says,
but part of the deal was they said, Russia, you'll sit this out, we'll cut up Poland. And Russia said, okay, we like that deal. But our history highlight of the day, and always not always good things. 1839, the British capture Hong Kong from China.
Oh.
And there's been no issues with Hong Kong ever since. And everybody's been happy.
Yeah.
So considering that we still talk about this, I kind of thought that should be the history highlight of the day.
That's a good one.
Did I miss anything?
Just a couple. So 1902, Fanny Farmer, among the first to emphasize the relationship of diet to health, opens her school of cookery in Boston. I just liked her name.
Fanny Farmer?
Yeah.
I like the School of Cookery.
Yeah, both. I mean, it all goes together, right? And of course, I think that's great, and a great connection she has there for diet to health.
There we go.
But also 1900, Booker T. Washington forms the National Negro Business League in Boston, Massachusetts.
Booker T.
Yeah. So
I like his name, Booker T. Washington.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun to say.
It is. It's kind of like Quila, which is said lots and lots of different ways.
Yeah, actually before anything else, talk about your name and where that comes from.
The name?
Yeah,
that's Finnish name. Mm-hmm. And it actually means lane. My uncle changed his name to Lane, L-A-N-E. It represents a lane in the forest. Uh-huh. You know, that's what it's named after, actually. A path in the forest.
The path taken.
Lane. Anyway, he did, to make simplify his name, he changed it to Jacob Lane, L-A-N-E. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You moved to Alaska, made it easier. All
sure.
That.
Well, Quila's a little more challenging because there is a J in there, folks, just in case you're wondering, somewhere.
Yes, it took me a while. Is it Kujala? Is it Quela? Is it Quila? Is it...
Yeah.
So, when I first went...
All of those. I hear all of them.
I think when
Kujala,
you have...
a lot of people, English people, are, you know, not Finns, say Kujala.
Kujala.
Yeah, a lot of them do.
So I think those of us with somewhat strange names, we just learn to listen for anything that's close and we respond to it.
Right.
Yeah.
When I met Mark's friends, I had learned that he let his friends say his last name incorrectly, pretty much like his entire life. And so at our wedding, we actually had a tutorial on how to say our name. And it was said to the audience, and then they had to repeat it back to us to learn it correctly because they learned it incorrectly.
That's fun.
So it was a good one.
So tell us a little bit about your life, your growing up and what your childhood was like and where you grew up and what that was like.
Well, I grew up here in Astoria, just a few blocks across from the mill pond, actually. And went to school, Astor School, Astoria High in Oregon State. And I did started fishing when I was probably 7th, 8th grade with set nets on the end of the dock. You could buy a license in those days for $7.50 and have a set net or a net on the end of the dock. I had three of those, and I had a skiff where I'd go and check them in the morning or in the evening after school. And, you know, certain times of year, they were productive, and I'd sell the fish to Union Fishermen's Co-op in Upper Town, it was all at the foot of 31st Street, and Upper Town is where I had permits to fish, three of them, three Point Adams, CRPA, and at Union Fish.
And what kind of fish were you catching?
Well, in February, it's mostly steelhead. They go right along the end of the dock. And then the springtime, I didn't really fish them because the fish were out deeper. I didn't get any, couldn't get any. And then in the summer, I'd get sockeye or blueback, we called them. Went off the end of that. They go right along the end of the dock, too. And then in the fall, by August, you get a lot bigger runs of fall chinook and silver salmon. That's then I'd fish that net then.
And this was...
They were more productive that time of year.
This was 7th and 8th grade when you started?
So, pardon?
This was 7th grade?
7th grade? 7, 8, 9.
And what did you do with the money that you made?
Oh, boy. I still got it. No. That's the last thing I remember what I did with it. But there used to be a favorite place in Upper Town where I lived. Name of it was Jager's. And all he sold was coffee and ice cream. And sold comic books, and in one half of it, in the other half there was men playing poker, but all the kids came and read the comics books set there or on the floor, read the comic book and then put them back. They didn't buy them. A lot of kids didn't buy them.
Anyway,
it was a good place to spend money, ice cream sundae and so on. Sodas and so forth, but yeah.
And was fishing in your family, or is that just a way that was easy for you to make some money?
I just happened to grow up there at the docks and spent a lot of time down on the docks when it was really good fishing. And
What did your parents do for a living?
Pardon?
What did your parents do for a living?
Well, my mother was a baker at home, baking for about 30, 40 years. She baked cakes and decorated cakes, wedding cakes and all that. And my father worked across the street at the mill. And he was also, after the mill closed, he was a refrigeration man fixing refrigerators at Tongue Point. He worked for the Navy at Tongue Point as a refrigeration man.
And it was your grandparents who came here from Finland. Did they come here?
Yeah. My grandfather, Jacob, came first. But they first came to Michigan, lived in Michigan. A lot of Finns lived in upper Michigan. It was jobs in mining, which not a lot of people liked. Mining coal, mining iron, mining. And that's where they ended up. And then they go from there. And he landed there and brought his part of his family, his son. I mean, my father and his brother, Andrew, and that, and his wife, first wife, She actually died. I didn't know that much about it, but he then moved to Astoria, and in between all that time, he became a pastor, kind of a self-educated pastor. He didn't go to a Bible college or anything, but he was a pastor of a church here in Astoria up at 10th and Irving. It's called an Apostolic Lutheran, Finnish Apostolic Lutheran Church. He preached in Finn. He didn't talk that much English, but he was a pastor, and as a pastor in those days, you could ride anywhere on a railroad free.
Oh.
So he loved that. He loved to go on a railroad for nothing, back to Michigan, up to Seattle, visit his children. But he grew up in the house there where we grew up. He didn't grow up there. He lived in the house, married again, where I grew up in Upper Town, crossing the mill pond.
Well, that seems like a much better job than mining, to be a preacher and to be able to get free railroad rides all over the country, much better than mining.
Yeah. He didn't, when he was in Astoria, when the time I knew him, he was, pastor all my lifetime. He never had did any other work particularly, he didn't have any other particular job other than pastoring that church up on the hill there. Yeah.
So I've heard stories that you built your own boat at a very young age.
Yeah, it was about the ninth grade. I made a boat that was... the mill was operating then. At that time, this is during the war, World War II, and they made a lot of really nice spruce lumber, like 5/8 inch thick, 12, 14 inches wide planks, straight grain out of spruce trees, because it's very flexible, lightweight. And they made airplanes out of it during World War II. The most famous one is Howard Hughes's Spruce Goose, a big, great, big plane he made. It flew about 100 yards. Anyway, that's my dad worked there. I got some of those planks, 12 inches wide, beautiful. And then there was a boat shop down at the foot of 31st Street, still there. And it's not a boat shop now, it's a business. But I made it in there, started it. Actually, it was like a big skiff, like a dory with a wide stern. And the whole boat looked exactly like the bow pickers that Oh. The actual Bob Pickard had a cabin and a bunk in there, and fish locker and everything, and what we called a skunk roller, which they used to use in the old days was with sailboats, was just a roller that you stuck up on the front of the boat, pulled a net in with. And I fished with half a net, half of the length of the ordinary net, about 100 fathom.
So I'm fascinated on two things. A skunk roller, why a skunk?
Well, I don't know. That's what they call them. Skunk roller.
I like that. And then I'm fascinated by you're making a boat that's seaworthy or river-worthy when you're in the ninth grade. When I'm in shop class making a really horrible birdhouse that doesn't even really fit together smoothly, I'm very impressed and amazed by that.
Because it didn't sink either. It actually worked.
Well, there were people that didn't necessarily help me, but they other fishermen instructions and so on help that way. But basically, I made it myself in there, upside down, it's like a big ship. Then turned it over and finished it inside, and like it was a regular fishing boat. And then this story gets longer and longer. I don't know how much time you got.
But we got enough time.
I had to get some power in there. I had an air-cooled engine, but that didn't work when I first tried it. So when I got another fisherman there from Klaskin, Vic Hendrickson, he took me, he said, let's go down and talk to the manager at Union Fish. It was Anton Sorensen. He was the manager for many years there. And we went down to talk to him, and Vic told Anton that I needed a new engine for that boat. Wasn't satisfactory what I had. And there was one out there that was out by Miles Crossing. It was a universal engine. It was only two cylinders and about 12 horsepower. And that's what we wanted. That's what Victor told me wanted. And he said, okay, go ahead and buy it. I think it was $800-$900, something like that. I can't remember. And then I installed that in there with the shaft and that and everything. And then the right up just down the street, just a little ways from here, was a blacksmith, Swenson, his name was. And he was a really good blacksmith, and he had the lower part of that building that's before you get to Gyro Field, that building is there. And he was a good blacksmith down there and worked alone. And then upstairs, he was a socialist. Upstairs was a meeting hall for the socialists. Oh. And that he had, yeah. But anyway, I talked to him and I got measurements and that. And he made the baskets for me. He made them. It was fun to watch him, a good blacksmith. He doesn't waste a blow. He doesn't waste any hammer blows, at a time. And he'd hammered out, made this basket that I fastened on, the rudder and stock and all that, and the keel skid there, and what do you call it? Anyway, he made all those things by hand down there in his blacksmith shop. I don't know what I paid him or whatever, but he was good.
And the records are all still there, including probably the tools that he used, because nothing was ever touched. It was all just left there. In the blacksmith shop. Yeah, he went home apparently and had a heart attack or something and died, and everything was just like a time capsule. So there's probably records of his work with you, and the hammer that he used is still there and everything else.
Wow.
Really? Downstairs, that building?
Yeah. And upstairs, the socialist hall, there's still lessons on the chalkboard of what you're supposed to read for tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
But you never went upstairs to the socialist hall.
No, I'd never been in that upstairs part. I was not at all interested in that.
So what happened to your boat? How long did you have it? Do you still have
it? Well, I fished it a couple of years, two, 3 years. I was about a sophomore in high school, I suppose, when I, they told me, well, you need a, or Victor was my mentor, sort of. He said, you need a bigger boat. You need a cannery boat. Go, let's go down the and ask the cannery. And they give, they immediately, in those days, they used to rent boats, you know, gillnet boats to anybody that had the money or wanted, or they trusted, let's put it that way. They would rent a boat to them for the year, provided they sell their, bring their fish to the Union Fish. So he went down, I got a boat immediately, or, you know, not immediately, but pretty soon, I sold that. I don't have a picture of the boat at all.
Yeah.
I wish I had one,
yeah,
but I don't. And I sold it to a guy that lived here for years in Astoria, and I never bothered to ask him either. Mm-hmm. And he's passed away since then, but he ran a charter boat for years after that. But he used it for a long time as a sport boat. But I got a gillnet boat, a regular size one, an older one. Actually, the first boat that I got from the cannery was one there. It was kind of one they didn't, nobody else wanted. And it was called, it was a double-ender with a, what they called a meager cabin, kind of like a barn cabin on it. And it was from up in Klaskanai, meager. Anyway, that's the first boat I had, but it was, you know, it wasn't that good of a boat. It was kind of, but in August, this is the time of year now when it's good fishing in the Columbia where we get fish. And I had this boat. I just started to go with it. And Vic, that, on a, like an evening high water, about 9 o'clock at night, that's some of the best tides where those fish come into the big salmon, tules, everything come into the river. 20-pound, 22-pound average or so. And I went, Victor said, he told me, come on with me tonight and we'll go over, take, follow me and see if it's going to be fish tonight. And so I did. I followed him across the river. And I what was called then between the beacons, it's above the, on the Washington side, about a couple miles from shore, I guess. Anyway, on the Washington side, and up above where the bridge is now, a ways. And he says, you see that? Vicky, come over. And he says, yeah, nice big Columbia boat, beautiful boat. And he says, he come over to me and he says, you see that oil? That's oil slick on the water there. Kind of an oil, it was kind of calm. And he said, lay out there, this fish here, lay out there, and I'll lay out from you and north. And which he did, it was just getting dark, it wasn't dark yet. And sure enough, boy, it, bam, water started splashing, a cork line, and fish started hitting the net right away. I got nervous. Anyway, I'm picking up, and the very first fish was a nice big Chinook, you know, about 22 pounds, and I opened the fish locker, and I threw it in the fish locker from over the fish, the nets pile there, you know, and it, the board and the fish locker board between the engine and the fish locker was all rotten, and its head went right, made a hole in that. Oh. Its head went into the engine room.
So no.
That's how old that boy, I mean, the boat wasn't first class shape. Anyway, and pulled back. But I did get almost a ton of fish that night out of that drift.
Wow.
All I could do to get that fish in, and then I turned around, went right straight to unload it, and Victor, he fished the rest of the night there, and you know, I don't know, he had 1.5 or 2 ton.
Wow.
But
so you decided, even though you were working and earning this money already, you decided to go to college. and then even to grad school. Why did you make that decision? It sort of seems
the
like,
what?
Why did you decide to go to college?
Well, in between her, I went into service. I was in the Marine Corps for a couple of years. And I got out, I had the, you know, you got the GI Bill, so you can go to college or things like that. Well, I hadn't planned. I was already fishing again in the river. At that point, I thought, fishing is good here. I could do this forever, you know. I like it. But then I got home from the Korean War ended, and a lot of my classmates and people I knew, young guys in Astoria, they had been drafted. They'd been in, some drafted, some joined. But anyway, they are all got out. They released a lot of people out of the service after that Korean War. And then I was about 1953 or 4. And then, well, it got kind of, had quite a bit of time in the evenings for young men to be. I did quite a bit of visiting all the taverns and the Fiesta Club and all those downtown there. Too many nights, you know. And so I got to thinking too, oh man, this isn't going good. And another classmate of mine from high school, Bob Erickson, he was already going to first year, and he had gotten out of the service too, and he was going to Oregon State. And I talked to him, and he was home or whatever, and he says, "Ah, he didn't come to school. He had the GI Bill too, you know. The GI Bill, come to school, get it." So that's what I did. Then I started in the middle of winter term and stayed there forever.
Yeah.
Or I don't know, I was there about 10 years, not to get a degree, but I worked for the oceanography department, and I had a master's degree and all that. But
and all that.
All that.
I mean, not your normal fisherman, I would think. And then you went on, and to summarize, you went on to open your own processing plant and cannery, one of the few remaining or that were at the time. Here in Warrenton, which was Oregon Ocean Seafoods, and then Skippin' on Brand Seafood, that was passed on to your sons. Mark ran the processing plant and cannery later in life, and Paul is still fishing today.
Yeah, well,
he's fishing today.
There's a lot of time in between there.
Yeah, there is.
I fished from Mexico to Bristol Bay. I fished the albacore with Rudy Lovell on the Torval for a few years, and Ainer Lovell. I fished the albacore down in California, Mexico. And then I trolled salmon, and I fished salmon. And I fished in Bristol Bay 3-4 years.
And what was your favorite place to fish?
Columbia River.
Is it still Columbia River? And then anybody in the fishing industry at all, I always have to ask, what's your favorite fish to eat? What's your favorite fish to eat?
Oh, well, spring Chinook or winter Chinook, if you want to get in February. You know, spring Chinook, winter Chinook. Yeah, that's the reason being is they come in, but they're not going to spawn until August. So they're living off the fat in their body.